whatever they were talking about and whomever they were talking about went a long way back.
Why? With Arcia Tecún.
Casalele, malo lele, buenas noches. Good to have Kehao Folau, Dino Diaz on. We'll start off with intros. Dino's been on before. Kehao, we have you on now. I'll bother you some more again in the future. A part of that intro, if you mind sharing a little bit about your experience with DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion work within institutions.
Okay, yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Kehao Folau. Panapen, Tongin. My mom's from Pingalap, Panape, and migrated to the States when she was 16. Dad is from Tonga, grew up in Fasi, and then they met at BYUH, moved here to Utah, and I was the first to be born and raised from Rose Park, now living in West Valley. But yeah, my experience in EDI work officially started out as an assistant director of the Graduate Schools Diversity Office at the U, University of Utah, then moved to Utah Valley University to be their director of equity, diversity, and inclusion. That was a rough one. Was the director for 6 months, then my supervisor left and was the interim chief diversity officer for a bit. Was burnt out and then went to be an executive assistant for that same supervisor at Vanderbilt University for the office of their equity, diversity, and inclusion. Then shortly, like a few months, she moved me to project manager. And so had various roles within it, but officially been a part of DEI work or work since the beginning of my career, but officially in DEI offices since 2018.
So my name is Dino Diaz. My full name is Agustin Diaz, but I was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. I came to Utah via BYU Idaho, and that was terrible. And I made my way to over here, and I've been educated here and everything. I've never been in any official role when it comes to DEI, but I would argue that we've practiced it in numerous ways in various positions that I had. And I've worked in numerous spaces in higher ed, everywhere from the state, USHI, Utah System of Higher Education, to a tribal college down in Blanding, Utah, USU Eastern. And that's been all those spaces I've carried out something like DEI, but again, never officially. And I've always been kind of critical of it in my own way, which people I think have misunderstood as like against the whole project, but it's complicated. But yeah, that's a little bit about me.
So we're going to get to that. But before we do, wondering if what your thoughts are, I both of you, in response to like what, first of all, I guess, how would we introduce it? What is it? In like the big sense of the words and the meaning, and then what is it inside an institution? So I think sometimes that's where those tensions may emerge, and it's what you're talking about, Dino.
Yeah. So DEI, EDI, JEDI, whatever acronym you want to arrange it. No one does DIE though, but this is another story. But diversity, inclusion, and equity has become buzzwords, but replacements for focus on race, gender, and disabilities. Although I would say at most institutions I've been at, it's mostly a focus on race, gender, and sexuality. Yeah, anything other than that has other offices, like even disability, they have the ADA compliance in that office. And so at least the offices I've worked for Didn't directly work with it, even though institutionally it includes, at least I've been told, it includes a focus on race, gender, sexuality, and disabilities. But yeah, do you not want to add anything to that?
I often refer back to like how it was quickly institutionalized, like, during the pandemic, George Floyd being an example. Like this happened and all of a sudden everyone rushed to it. Like it was always being thought of. It was being like considered in various spaces and institutions. And I would even argue corporate like systems. But as soon as that happens, everyone rushes to it. Everybody, And I feel like at one point in the beginning, and I'm not sure, Cal, if you feel this way, because I think you have, for me, you have a lot of experience in that world on an institutional level. I feel like initially it was very thought of as like a higher administrative level. Like, okay, we're gonna put these folks with the C-suite, we're gonna put them in the upper chambers of leadership. But then little by little, you see those offices moved into like HR. And that's by design, right? Like what, and that's like a way to depower certain positions, right? We're just going to put them against another bigger bracket of offices. And HR is a good example because it's like employee engagement, it's employee wellness, things like that. But it also, when you move something like that from the upper leadership down to like even like a level below, right? Then you effectively also dismantle it in some ways, right? So I feel like you saw that trend. I'm not sure if that was the case. What I don't know, what do you think? You feel like that was the case where at the U or UBU?
Oh, for sure. I mean, at the U, I think they're still fighting for it, right? Because it still has a C-suite or a cabinet suite or a cabinet seat. But UVU, right after I left, it moved into HR. Because my supervisor, which you all know, Belinda, she was fighting. She was just like, no, that's the dumbest move. That would be a move backwards to move it under HR. And you touched this in your article. I think it's about control because diversity, or it was interesting because, yeah, I was reading your article and a lot of, yeah, when you do search it, it says that it starts in the 60s, but actually, it was mostly trainings on how to implement affirmative action that was starting in the 60s. And affirmative action only started as a riot control because of urban unrest. And they're like, we need to bring mainly Black folks into these institutions, into education, higher ed, into the workforce, into corporate America, to really control what was happening. Because after MLK's assassination, riots were going off everywhere in America. I think one report was just like there were 60 riots that went off simultaneously in the US. And so, what comes shortly after? Affirmative action. And so, it's definitely about a way of control. And I like how you say, yeah, institutionalized even further.
No, yeah. And like, I think even so, I work in the corporate sector now, and it's infamous. Like, DEI is never its own, like, C-suite or cabinet or board member, whatever. It's part of the HR department now and forever, right? And that's by design, right? So, and it's just interesting to me.
So like it's just it, moving down in the hierarchy of these kind of bureaucratic organizations, yeah.
Yeah. And like, moving down the hierarchy, but in a way that gives it extra visibility to like control and how it maneuvers, And there's no better place for that than HR, because HR controls so much of an organization's like base of operations, And so like by doing that, you have a really good thumb on the practice and the work that comes out of that field. At least that's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I would even say when it's in the C-suite or even the cabinet level, it's still performative because you oftentimes, they're the smallest department. They have the smallest funding. They have no actual control in making change besides within their department, and are considered mostly like consultants if they are, whether it be to different colleges or different leadership. At least in my experience, there's been very little power that comes with those positions anyway, whether they're in HR or at the highest level.
Even like thinking about affirmative action, I remember, I think you were the one that brought it up to me initially back in the day, and we're talking about how like even affirmative action, right, the results were like not necessarily what one would expect in terms of the stereotype around it, because it was benefiting white women more than any other, marginalized group, or group that was being oppressed and excluded. You did mention something that Dino also writes about, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I do want to bring it up because it's interesting for me to think about like the word performative and how it's used, particularly here in the US context, because it's almost as if saying that it's not as powerful or meaningful, perhaps. But like for me, performance is it's a very powerful tool, or like practice, whether it's performance arts within indigenous contexts, or even if we think about even in like gender theory of like the performance of gender, like that performance is enacting and doing something. So I wonder if performative, is a power, right? But it's a power to undermine by, by performing diversity in an institutional context. And perhaps that's more of a liberal strategy than, let's say, the proto-fascist one. But I'm just curious, because you both have used performative, and I'm not, again, the quote that you used in your article, Dino, which is DEI can't save us, so why do we try so hard to save it? You quote Sarah Ahmed, which is, it's a brilliant quote, and I agree. And I'll just share that quote real quick, right? So in Dino's article, it says Sarah Ahmed calls this, or calls the show of diversity the non-performative. She writes, "In the world of the non-performative, to name is not to bring into effect. The failure of the speech act to do what it says is not a failure of intent or even circumstance, but is actually what the speech act is doing." Anyway, so I'll turn it over to both of you. Performative, and why you use it, or what do you mean by it, and yeah.
Well, and that's fair because, like, in the sense of like how we use it here, and like, in the U.S. space, in the U.S. context, and how it's being used in different places, right? And that's a fair assumption of like, okay, this is what the impact of these meanings are very different and unique. I think for me here, I was struck by Sarah Ahmed's work because at first it took me a minute to wrap my mind around it, right? Like even just the wording of that quote, I was like, what the hell does that mean? But when you really dwell with it, it's almost like it speaks to the very sinister nature of systems, right? That's they're so covert, they're so impactful and threaded throughout everything that it's almost so difficult to see the impact. You have to really dig deep, and like we need to think really critically about systems. And like by thinking really critically of systems, you can see how they recycle these outlets of power to only bolster themselves, and so for me, that like that term of non-performative, it makes so much sense because I saw it. And I couldn't really explain how it unfolded, but I saw it and I felt it, right? I think I felt it more than anything, right?
I love that you brought Sarah Ahmed up because L Daniel, you didn't read the part, but one of my favorite things that she said was, and Dino, you put this in your article, was like, by saying that you're gonna do it, or what was it? By saying you're gonna do something allows the thing to not be done. And yeah, I think at least the institutions that I worked for, words definitely did not match deeds. Policy changes did not match practice. I left my job at the U for UVU because I really did believe in my supervisor, and she was doing crazy, like there was a crazy strategic plan that was in place at UVU, but then once she left, and it was like, okay, yeah, now she's gone, we can cut it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I spent more time trying to defend it than actually working on it. And it was pretty crazy. It was like 125 actions, but all doable, all across like different colleges agreed to do different things. And so just tracking it became definitely a deed or like hard to do, but like what was even harder was to was fighting the white men in cabinet, saying like, Belinda's not here anymore, we don't need to do it. And then yeah, right when I left, a month later, we got notice that it was cut. And I was just like, all that work for nothing, for nothing. All those emails at 3 a.m. for nothing. I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, this sucks. And so I think that's why I use the word performative, because yeah, words don't match, or deeds don't match words. And practice definitely doesn't match this tedious process of policy changes. Like, there's a whole bureaucracy in how to change policies, at least in the institutions I've been at, but rarely did I see any change in actual practice. Yeah, I like how you used Sarah Ahmed, because she says it perfectly in her book. I think it's be or being included. Yeah,
I'm being included,
on being
yeah.
included. Yeah.
Which like the title of that is so like it's like powerful, right? Because it's like, isn't this what we want? But then we have to think twice about, is this truly what we want, you know? Yeah, so we have 261, right, Cal,
HB.
or HB, you're right, HB 261, which effectively, like the general idea is that it would ban DEI practices, specifically from hiring, and some of those other contexts right there, but it does so along any government-funded institution, so K through 12 education, also in higher education, because they receive government funds too. And within the government context itself as well. What people, and I feel like there have been videos of the right kind of coming out and saying, this won't impact your BSUs, this won't impact, you know, all the great work done by folks, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, if it's so great, then why are you saying, like, why are you all like trying to do this? Because in the bill itself, and I find so many instances, and I think you've mentioned this, Daniel, like it's all about the language, right?
Yeah.
Like so much of it is vague enough where I'm like, you can use that to effectively get rid of any student club that is, you know, of a specific affiliation easily, you know, or you can use this as to build a platform to get rid of an entire center if you want. That's like, for me, that's some of the context. And that's where it like, it's sad. And I think, because I've gotten heat for what I've written too. Like I've gotten like people tell me like, yo, you're wrong. And this is why I'm like, yeah, I probably am wrong. You're right. Or like I am not considerate of like the reality of some of these things, but I think I'm just tired of folks like counting on it or relying on it entirely, you know, as if it would truly like be the future and save us. And I don't know, those are some of my thoughts, but that's some of the context behind HB 261.
Yeah, Daniel, I was interested in what connections you see with what's happening in Aotearoa right now.
Well, when I was at Waipapa-Tomotoro University of Auckland, you know, there's targeted admission schemes, and they were regularly kind of controversial for those who are on the center right and far right. And at the moment, right, like there's attempts to reinterpret Te Tiriti o Waitangi, the Treaty of Waitangi, as well to, again, the same kind of like how to undermine it and the authority that it has. And oh, the difference there, right, is that you have a treaty that not everybody signed, but most Hapu did, and it's a, you know, on one hand it's a more practical document, and at least in my experience, to work from, because it's one that you're working from at a national level. It's trickier in the context here, but so that is the governing thing text, right? Where here I feel like race is usually the overdetermining factor around justice, as opposed to indigeneity, right? And so DEI often like brings in indigeneity and colonial tensions within the multicultural frame, right, of civil society in terms of like civil rights, right, versus indigenous rights. And so that is a distinction between the two countries in terms of over there, you're beginning at the point of a treaty-based tension or conversation, where here it is about race. And over there, there isn't always the conversation around race. And so, like, I feel like the politics is overdetermined by indigeneity colonization there, and it's overdetermined by race here in terms of these issues of power. But I do see, yeah, a lot of similar tensions and ideas around language and languaging and intended meanings, but ultimately attempting to undermine, but with different strategies, right? And I can't help but think of Ibram Kendi, and I know, you know, there's different perspectives around that, but you know, his take on assimilationist versus segregationist, that ultimately are both part of a racist project. And I can't help but think about that in the current debates around, I would call, the aesthetics of how do you maintain a white supremacist, anti-black colonial cis-heteropatriarchy running, right? That's also capitalist. Do you do it through segregation and proto-fascist kind of attempts of either ignoring or no, we don't want that at all, and or we're going to eradicate that, or do you do it through inclusion, right? And assimilation projects of how do we, like what you mentioned with the history of affirmative action, how do we control or how do we discipline, neutralize, this unrest? But ultimately, they work in tandem, at least in the way that I think about this world and this society. And so I do lean towards your. I don't think you're wrong, you know, in terms of it won't save us. I also agree, you know, that because of our reality, it's required for our immediate survival as well. And so I'm not against it. But I, in
Right.
theory, I agree that it should not be where our investment is in terms of the long-term struggle, because I don't think it will save us either, because I do see it as the assimilation liberal politic of the same overall politic of white supremacist colonial capitalism.
Daniel, how did people respond? Because like obviously we have a response happening here now. There's been a response nationwide in different ways, in different contexts, but and there's one here too, obviously, right? But how did the people over there respond to like what was happening with the treaties and so forth?
I mean, at the moment, there's a lot of, you know, people organizing, you know, big hui's and meetings from what I've been following. And that's one thing that I do miss is like, man, Maori organized, man, and they come together. But I guess I think about that in terms of not just over there, but here, but over there, thinking about what does it mean to be an accomplice in relation to those struggles and organizing behind that, which is a lot more visible than it is here in terms of organizing around an indigenous politic. But I do think about that here because, you know, DEI does affect, you know, like in terms of the state level government. But if we had better accomplice relationships with local tribes, you're dealing now on a different politic, which also has its limits in terms of recognition politics, but it has a much larger frame in terms of federal power, right? And when we think about even civil rights movement in the US, right? It took federal interventions in terms of, you know, interventions in the South, whether it's overcoming Jim Crow or other, you know, racial violence, et cetera. And it is interesting for me to see that not happening. And again, two very different countries, very different scales in terms of population, in terms of organizing factors. And so I'm not saying they're equivalent, but I do think about that in terms of, would this be the same issue if the relationship to justice was through different means, right? What would it have meant if there's a more robust relationship with tribes and the push for governance of tribes and even considering the limits of recognition politics for even tribal nations? Like it does mean that you can leverage a federal level approach, which was what was also needed in terms of civil rights getting pushed through, right?
That brings me to thinking, because like a lot of my critiques of DEI come from like indigenous political thought, Glenn Coulthard, you know, Simpson, all these other people who've spoken about refusal and things like that, but also amongst like the Black radical tradition, Roderick Ferguson, Sylvia Winter, like all these people have spoken about these things, like you know, Black Afro-pessimism, so forth, and They have valid points, every single one of them. And Cal, I'm gonna shout you out because I was in a meeting where I was kind of ranting on it, and these administrators were like, "Well, Tina, what the hell would you want to do then? Like, how do you fix it? What would you do?" And I'm like, "That's so classic. That's so classic administrator. So like, well, this is really hard to think about. So what would you do? You know?" And I cited you, Kehao, because you said this in class one time. I was like, my friend Kehao Fula, they said what we really need is relationality. And they were like mind struck. They were like, "What? Like, what is that? And like, what reference in what way, right?" And then Daniel, you mentioned how that fight or that resistance here will look very different if folks actually have stronger relations with the tribes here in the state specifically. And I point that out, Cal, because I haven't forgotten about that, because in my mind is like relationality is more focused on like on each other, right? On who we see and how we feel about each other and how we work together versus like the thing we're seeking to change, like within the electoral politics, within the system like itself. Like it's more about what are we changing with each other, which is still, you can have the best DEI planned out, but you can still have racialization still has its impact amongst various communities, and how that unfolds in a way that, still creates division, still doesn't, allow us to see one another, to work together, to feel with one another. So that always come, I always come back to that. And I think, Daniel, what you just said is actually really powerful, because I think that brings in the decolonial aspect of like why we're so focusing so hard on colonial tools of power to simply reach and just recycle them, reach and renew them, and just have the same thing over again.
Right, and you don't need to quote me, because I've taken that from basically a bunch of folks. Daniel being one too. I know if anything, my time at UVU while being the chief diversity officer was the shift to trying to focus on the relations that we were in. Like folks in colleges, like focus what's in front of you and also what it's connected to, which really is everything. And so it really is, I think that picture is a lot different than when you go to racial politics or any type of identity politics. It will come up because that's our current situation now, but it would be interesting to see how we work through that. And even to think of, yeah, what would it look like if we pushed for tribal governance, or at least them having a bigger say. But that would still allow for state intervention, or yeah. And so it gets tricky, because even in your article, when you were like, yeah, let's turn to community, and I'm like, yeah, for sure. And also, I have a bunch of bills. So like, then what happens to those, And so yeah, I think it'd be interesting to see what happens. I mean, they've been pushing for this. They've been there's anti or yeah, there'd been anti-affirmative action since affirmative action became a thing. And now I feel like, at least at Vanderbilt, right? Vanderbilt created the Office for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion right after George Floyd had Belinda come in. And then right when the buzz came down, it dissolved. I was out of a job. And so it's going to be interesting to see how these trends go. But yeah, definitely.
I do hope, like, it honestly, like, part of me was like, I don't know, this is kind of bad to say. I was like, good, maybe people will get politically like freaking motivated now, or like, people will start like responding in ways that we haven't before, And maybe, but what I hope it does is that it doesn't ask for the same thing, I hope it's like students, educators, community members, whoever, accomplices, whatever, rallying around this idea of like, y'all just suck as a legislature, and like just y'all need to just go down, or like confront some serious power, like bigger power dynamics at play, But I don't see that happening. But I think it's a worthwhile project or experience for folks to become politically like rejuvenated and demand again, you know? Like you saw that during Black Lives Matter, you saw it during the pandemic, you saw it, these or even Palestine right now, right? Like these situations where like people are rising up in ways that haven't happened in a long time. And so what does it mean to continue that momentum in rejuvenated ways, right? So this policy is the same, it's the same shit. Like it goes back and forth, right? One year you have something, the next year you don't. And then it just goes back and forth all the time, especially in a state like this. You know, the year before we passed ethnic studies. Now we pass this. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I'm confused.
The things you put forward, you know, are appealing in terms of like the theory side of me, right? And I think that's what I want to invest in terms of the long term. I do understand the need for immediate survival, right? So like you mentioned, Cal, right? Like, and write a bunch of bills, right? I think that sometimes my frustration with, and I think you mentioned it to me once, you know, and like, you might have got it from somewhere. I can't remember if it was you, but like solutions is a bad word for it, but something along those lines, right? Like, the most appropriate responses aren't going to come from here. And you were talking about thinking about quote unquote third world politics, right? And I feel like there's
Lola. Lola was the one that said that.
okay, yeah.
Lola, yeah.
And so I think about that because I feel that, right? Like when I think about the way people mobilize in Guatemala, which is it's a very different point of starting point. And I think that's why I do like, you know, the Black radical tradition and Afro-pessimism as well, in terms of this, and like it's theorizing the end of the world because it's saying you cannot reconcile this world, and so you have to be against it. And I can vibe with that in terms of like, yeah, like perhaps that is part of the issue, is that we need a much more robust radical politic that isn't as compromising. And I understand why compromises happen, right? And especially intergenerationally. When you look at the historical contexts and you look at the context of power and how that remains, but nonetheless has changed over time, I can't help but empathize and understand the choices made to compromise in those moments. And at the same time, you know, seeing how we're continually resulting in, you know, different manifestations of that same ongoing hegemony is kind of like, no, I don't want to compromise between being human and non-human because that makes me a subhuman. Like, no thanks. Like, I'll be against the world. Say, I want another world altogether. Okay, how what were you gonna say?
No, listen, the world. You make so many good points. Like, I feel like there's been so many compromises. And at the same time, these compromises could also be called interest convergence for those who are in power. And so I just wonder when that shift is going to happen, if it's going to happen, and what would that look like if we had to imagine the end of the world. What are these shifts? So that, yes, we're making compromises so we can survive in the moment, but also a lot of these compromises are still benefiting the other side. And when I say other side, I mean capitalism, patriarchy, like it's benefiting these structures more than it is us. I see the appeal of imagining or just yeah saying there's no redeeming to this world. There's no redeeming to any of these institutions. And yeah, Dino, that's why I mean I also agree with you. Like DEI is not going to save us. It's not. But then the fun part comes. Like what will? And I don't know, fun, hard, I don't know, sad. I think a lot of the points that I see are healing have also brought me a lot of pain, and I have to thank DEI for that. Like the only reason I got into the U was because I was a diversity scholar and because I fell within that 5% that wasn't accepted. And so thank you, affirmative action. I got it in now that it's banned. Hopefully I can still bring my people in, you know. But yeah, until PE becomes political education. We'll see what those imaginings of the end of the world and new worlds look like.
Yeah, I like freak. I love that because as much crap as I give to like all those DEI plans and strategies, initiatives, whatever you want to call them, like when I first got to UVU, I was kicked out of BYU Idaho, right? And surprise, surprise, right?
Kicked
And
out.
so,
Thank you. Kick me
why?
again.
What honor code did you break?
You need to stop
Which
asking
one?
questions, bro.
Which ones? No, I'm just kidding.
But in being kicked out, like, and then arriving to a place like UVU that had like a multicultural center and people, and I spent every day there, right? Even if they didn't give me anything great or whatever, they didn't like, the educators there at the time didn't provide me like a ton of support. It was the people around there, right? That we counted on each other. We formed student clubs, we formed study groups, we went out to eat all the time, we hung out together, right? And I couldn't have made it without that, honestly, and so as much crap as I give to all these multicultural diversity, DEI, whatever, it was my lifeline, and I think that's why I never forget what you said, Kehao. Even if you picked it up from somewhere, it's all good, right? You're my lineage to it. I never forget, like, relationality for me is what saved like my education. My friendships, my community there, because I built community there, right? And so even if we are imagining the world, the end of the world, I'd much rather imagine it in tow with somebody else, with my homies. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like when I have that down, then so much more is even possible afterwards, right? And I think as an example, I'm writing a paper with two students from the Center for Social Impact that I used to work at, which, by the way, out of all the places I worked at UVU, that place has so much of my heart. It was an incredible space. We did incredible work. I get emotional thinking about it because we really did do incredible work. And we did an alternative break with majority Latina students. I think there was like one white student, but they were super cool. And that crew has remained together throughout the years. They've organized separately outside the institution. They're like linking with each other inside the institution. You know what I mean? And for me, like, that was the most beautiful thing to see. And that's why I never forget what you say, Cahal, about relationality. Like, that to me is where the revolution seems to be at. So.
I met Dino through we're shared cohort, right, in our master's program. And it's that, I mean, I am grateful to my parents and different political lineages that I come from that planted seeds of critical consciousness. And I had these little different moments, but it was suppressed because of the context that we were raised in, K-How. And so, getting to a point where that could be unleashed, right? And K-How was a big part of that too. All of a sudden, it's just like, oh, wow, like, yeah, like the thing that's facilitated my critical consciousness to see these issues and limitations is happening in this paradoxical moment in space, because it's happening in the space that I'm critiquing, right? And I think that is part of the critical consciousness, that it is, there is, if there wasn't something to it, like, we wouldn't care enough to say, hey, there's limits here. And I think that passion exceeds the institution, right? And so the frustration often comes with the machine, right? The big moving parts of a large bureaucracy. Because, yeah, I mean, like, my critical consciousness came through uni. Like, I'll critique the uni till the end of the day, right? At the same time, I ain't gonna tell people not to go. I went there. I mean, I'm in debt for life, but like, I always joke, I was like, I borrowed privilege, right? That's what my student loans are, right? I borrowed the privilege of time. And not that I didn't have the capacity, intellectually speaking, but I didn't have the economic capacity of time. And that was the difference between me and a different class structure, right? Was that I needed those loans to buy me privilege for a moment in time to read, to think together with others. And it is those relationships, like the conversations we'd have in the hallway, right? Or outside of class. And we're still friends. I mean, I know sometimes you get mad at me, but we still friends, right? And so there is something worthwhile to it. And I think that's the interesting thing about it, is our critique, I think, comes out of a love for the larger issue, and the frustration with the barriers that are more apparent when we're able to be in that space. Because that changed for me. Like, I all those suppressed seeds of critical consciousness were unleashed because of the people that I was able to encounter in a more diverse setting than the other mainstream ones in this state that I have been raised in amongst. But yeah, Kehao, what do you think?
No, I agree. I mean, I think that's why I fell in love with the undercommons, because I was just like, oh, this is what I'm experiencing. Like, even if I was in DEI spaces and those trainings, leading those trainings were like pulling teeth. But then there'd be that one person who was just like contributing to the conversation and be like, oh, you get it. You get it. I'll meet you after. Let's go get boba after. You know? And so it's like, it's these people you meet along the way that are just like, yeah. And Daniel, I think you told me, I think I was still in my undergrad, but you were like, man, all my friends are smarter than me. And like, I don't mind being the dumbest in the room. And I'm like, Daniel, you're always the smartest in the room. Like, shut up, you know? But then I hung out with you, and I think it was Rob, and I forgot the white kid's name. But just listening to your guys' conversation, I was just like, oh man, this is the friends I want to surround myself with. Like, these conversations are badass. These relationships really have been lifelines. Like, UVU was rough, especially after Belinda left. Like, being interim chief diversity officer, I thought I was going crazy. I was losing my hair. I was just like, am I pulling it out or is it the stress? I don't know. But like Dino, and like, yeah, it was the people. It was the people that I was just like, okay. And the students. Like, I see these students, and I think it was the naive part of me too, of like, I can make a change. And then, you know, being removed from it, I'm just like, okay, at least I still have these friends. At least I still have these relationships. All the changes that I wanted to make, you know, nothing happened. But yeah, it's these people. Thanks, you
We
guys.
kind of remember the guild, like that was like all of like a bunch of us started like just connecting with each other, you know, and I think, yeah, I think after you left, Cal, that kind of just like filtered out too, because a lot of people started leaving, a lot of people. That was the great resignation time of higher ed, you know.
I started the
So
Exodus. I'm
you
happy.
did. Respect, respect.
Man, but thinking of the guild, also, Daniel, we had this group, right? We were trauma bonding so much.
We cried a lot. We cried
And
so
I
much.
think at the end of that, I was just like, I no longer want to trauma bond. Like, I want joy. I want happiness. Forget this, you know? But then, you know, being back in the modern current time, have to deal with these. But yeah, I don't think DEI can save us, but it definitely has given me a few things that I could benefit from.
All right. Maloa, gracias. Thanks, everybody.